deal with thy servants? So he says, prove us. Give us 10 days. Let us eat pulse. And the best I can understand of the word pulse here, it means some kind of a grain or vegetable food. They wouldn't eat this meat off the king's table, but give us this pulse. And give us 10 days, and at the end of 10 days, then, if our countenance is not as good as the others, if our countenance doesn't suit you, then you deal with us as you see fit. So it seems to be a fair trial. So he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days, and at the end of 10 days their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Well, they were doing better than the rest. And the way he describes it here, you know, it's kind of like if you're fattening out two groups of hogs and you're trying to see which one did the best on a certain kind of food. Well, this is the way they were doing. And they were fairer and fatter than the others. So apparently they were doing well on this pulse. And Daniel's refusal to defile himself with the meat from the king's table then was bearing him in good stead. And one characteristic we have to note of Daniel is that during all the time of his captivity, and it was practically all of his life here, he remained true to God. Although he was in a foreign country, in a completely foreign element, he had all kinds of temptations to do this and to go like the rest went and to follow these pressures put upon him. But those things that violated God's law, he refused to do. He did not violate God's will for him. Now, by the same token, though, he did not try to overthrow this government, didn't make any kind of an insurgence or uprising against it. Everything they did was toward the help of the government, although it had completely taken them away from their home and uprooted them and put them in a foreign country. They had all kinds of reason to feel bitter and resentment, but not one word here about any kind of resentment or trying to overthrow or trying to undermine this government. Yet he remained true to God on those things that he felt he might violate God's will in if he followed their desires. But instead of doing it in a violent, resentful way, he worked out a plan. First of all, he was a good friend of the man. He was in favor with him. He wasn't a sullen, rebellious person. And he worked out a plan where he could still conform to what this man wanted and still please God. You can see how somebody could have handled this matter a little bit differently here and not been able to do what Daniel did and his three friends. Thus Belshazzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. As these four children, God gave them knowledge. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now God gave them skill, gave them learning, gave them wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Now this would have to be the end of the three-year period. Brought them in. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. Now it seems that there was not just Daniel and his three friends, but there were many others here, and not just others from Judea, but from other lands of the conquerings of these Babylonians. They had conquered this whole part of the world. And so Judah was just one little province that was brought in. They also conquered Egypt and all of the territories round about Assyria and brought them in. So they were competing, so to speak, or they were being judged in amongst many others, probably from all over the world, the fairest, the most educated, the most brilliant, the most healthy that could be. And here Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah stood tall and outstanding among them. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. So we have a little, that last verse of that chapter throws in a little extra comment there. Daniel went even to the first year of King Cyrus, and Cyrus is the man who came in and overthrew the Babylonian Empire. And it became then the Medo Empire, and we'll get into that later. So he lasted the entire length of this empire. And this verse 20 probably has to do with the majority of Daniel's life. In all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And really, he probably at this particular time here hadn't inquired of them of anything. But he was going to find them this way. Now we get into the second chapter of Daniel. Now this King Cyrus, he captured Babylon in the year 538 B.C. And I think Daniel was even spoken of in 535. So he was in within the first 3 years of Cyrus's reign even. And probably he would have had to have been somebody 80 or 90 years old or older. Say he was 20 when he came into Babylon. Well, he'd have to be 80 or 85 or 90 years old at the time then that we last read him. Now, beginning chapter 2, verse 1, and in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled and his sleep brake from him. He dreamed dreams, and it troubled him, trying to understand and figure out what this dream was about, or these dreams were about, and he couldn't sleep. Then the king commanded to call the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans for to show the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. Now, wasn't able or didn't take enough time to go into a good deep definition of the meaning of all these persons here. But he names the magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans. It's hard for me to differentiate between all of them. The astrologers, of course, would be people who dealt with the stars and the heavenly bodies to determine their prophecies. The sorcerers would deal with some other kind of magical, supernatural power or powers. And the magicians would also deal with a brand or type of supernatural powers. Then he names a group here known as the Chaldeans. As though these, we don't know what the Chaldeans were, except that they probably came from this area of Chaldea originally. They were the original Babylonians. They weren't foreigners who'd been imported or captured to get here, and they were set aside as even a separate group themselves. They stood before the king, and the king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Sirach. Now, right at this point in the prophecy, the book of Daniel is written in the language of the Chaldeans. It's in Hebrew up to this point. Now it goes to the language of the Chaldeans, and it stays in the language of the Chaldeans to the 7th chapter. So the translators have to be able to translate from the language that the Babylonians spoke, Sirach, not Hebrew. This is the language that of this nation now, in which Daniel was a prisoner. So they spake in Sirach, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we'll show the interpretation. Now this sounds to me like really this is, sure enough, room for fakery or mockery. You tell us the dream, and we'll tell you what it means. But it wasn't going to be this easy at all. And today, you know, somebody could tell me a dream and I can give them some kind of an interpretation. They couldn't prove them wrong. I could interpret it, just give me what the dream is. Tell me the dream. But this wasn't going to be this easy for these people. The king answered and said unto the Chaldeans, The thing is gone from me. If you'll not make me known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, you shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. The king couldn't remember the dream. He said, It's gone from me. If you can't tell me what the dream is, as well as the interpretation of it, I'm going to cut you to pieces, destroy your houses. Now, this would make it quite a bit different for somebody to walk up to you and say, You tell me what I dreamed last night, and then you tell me what it means. Because then it's hard to fake that, because the king just might remember what the dream was. Well, this looked like an impossible task. He says, But if you show the dream and the interpretation thereof, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. They answered and said again, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we'll show the interpretation of it. They weren't about to give the dream. You tell us the dream. Just tell us what it is, and we'll give you the interpretation. As though the interpretation is real easy if you just tell us what the dream is. The king answered and said, I know of a certainty that you would gain the time, because you see the thing is gone from me. Now, it's hard to know just what he is saying here. He's probably saying, Well, I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to gain a little time because you see it's gone from me. In other words, if they just get a little bit of time here, maybe the king would remember the dream, or maybe the king would soften. Maybe they could come up with something. And he wasn't wanting them to buy time. He was wanting them to give the interpretation. But if you will not make me known unto me the dream, if you're not making known unto me the dream, there is but one decree for you, for you have prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me the interpretation thereof. He says, I'll have a lot more confidence in your ability to interpret this dream if you just tell me what it is. You tell me the dream, then I'll know you can interpret it. Now, this is really a new angle on these people. They weren't expecting anything like this at all. The Chaldeans answered before the king and said, There's not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asks such things of any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. There's not a man on the earth who can do this, and consequently there's never been a ruler that's ever asked anything like this before. You're asking the impossible. You're unreasonable. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth. And there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. So they just told him, the only way you're going to get your request is to have the gods to tell you, and they don't even live here. You're going to have to find somebody that doesn't dwell in flesh and blood to give you your request. It's a rare thing you're asking for. No other king's ever done it. And no other man will be able to give you the interpretation and the answer. For this cause the king was angry and very furious and commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Now, of course, this command would include Daniel. Daniel was counted as one of these wise men and his three Hebrew friends. But the decree went out as an all-sweeping decree. You've all failed. So you're all going to be destroyed. And the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they sought Daniel and his fellows to be slain. Now, the king just wasn't going to have any fooling around about this. He wanted it done and done now. And they say, according to history, that this was many times the manner in which these great kings operated in the past. When they decided to have something done, it was done then. If that meant put somebody to death, immediately he was put to death. There was no trial, there was no judge, no jury, no setting of a sentence. Then was when it was. And this thing existed right on even down to the time of John the Baptist. Whenever Herod made a poor deal with his stepdaughter Herodias and agreed to let her have John's head on a platter, and so whenever he made the agreement, he pronounced it was to be done, and it was done then. No recourse for John. No second thought. It was done. So here they are now going to carry this decree out that these wise men be put to death. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Now, as I understand this interpretation of captain of the king's guard, it's also interpreted as the king's chief butcher or the king's chief executioner. So he came to slay the wise men of Babylon. And he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. He told Daniel what it was all about. Then Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time, that he would show the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house and made the thing known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, that they would desire mercies of the God of heaven concerning this secret. Now, they realized that no man on earth could do this thing that the king answered all, asked for also. They realized it would have to be somebody that didn't dwell among the flesh of men to bring this thing about. But they had a God that they could appeal to. So they desired mercies of the God of heaven, that he would make known this secret, that Daniel and his fellows should not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, of course, these are probably events that God had brought about so that he would have the opportunity to demonstrate himself in the midst of all this idolatry, in the midst of these wise and knowledgeable men of the paganistic ways, to demonstrate himself there through the actions of his own servants. Then the secret was revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel didn't the first thing just up and say, oh, look how great I am. I've got the answer. The first thing it seems here, he blessed the God of heaven. He gave thanks for God having revealed this thing to him. Verse 20, Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Now this is his prayer and his blessing to God. Blessed be. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. How easily it would have been for Daniel and his friends to have forgotten about God. Here we got ourselves in a bad fix, folks, and we don't look like there's going to be any way out of it. We're just going to have to live by our wits. Now they turned to God. And then whenever God gave them the answer, they praised God. Blessed be the name of God. May his name live forever and ever. For wisdom and might are his, and he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me now what we desired of thee. For thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. Well, this is quite a prayer that Daniel prayed. And to me, one of the outstanding things here is this fact that he states about the fact that he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them at no understanding. So God is the one then that removeth kings and setteth up kings. We're now living under Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar is wicked in some ways. He's almost put us to death. But God put him in this position. He removeth kings and he setteth up kings. He's the one then who sets the changeth the times and the seasons. The seasons are the events, and the times are the distance between these events. And Daniel recognized this. And so it helped Daniel then to have this thing that we know as one of our great principles today, godliness with contentment. Daniel was able to be content in his predicament, in his situation, because he recognized that God sets these kings up. He removes them, and he sets them up. He's the one that changes the times and the seasons, and he gives understanding and wisdom to men. Of course, today, our true wisdom and understanding comes still from God, from his word. Therefore, Daniel went in unto Arioch, whom the king had ordained to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus unto him, Destroy not the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show unto the king the interpretation. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste, and said thus unto him, I have found a man of the captives of Judah that will make known unto the king the interpretation. I found a man among those captives we got from Judah down there who he says he can make known the interpretation. The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, Art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, The secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers show unto the king. But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Now Daniel didn't pretend that he got this from any other source. That all these astrologers and wise men that you've got here, they can't show it to you. But he says, there's a God in heaven that can. So he began to tell Nebuchadnezzar about the true God, about the living God. And this reminds us some of the Apostle Paul, as he was talking among the idolaters. He said, well, you've got so many gods here, you're too superstitious. You've even got one God to the unknown God. And that's the God I've come to tell you about, the living God, the God that you don't know about. And so Daniel took opportunity, saving his neck from the sword or from the chopping axe. But just before he did it, and we might jump into wanting to tell the king what he wanted, he said, I want you to know there's a God in heaven that reveals these things. That's where it all comes from, a God in heaven. And he shall reveal what shall be in the latter days. Now the latter days has to be the last dispensation of time. Not all of Nebuchadnezzar's dream would have to do with the latter days, but a part of it would. It's going to even last into the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head are upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into my mind upon thy bed. What should come to pass hereafter? And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. Daniel's building up now. He's going to tell him about this dream. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Now, this verse is hard to interpret and explain. But it seems what he's saying here is that the purpose of this dream is not just for me. It's not so that I'll have more wisdom than anybody else or be thought of as a wise man particularly. But it's for the sakes of the things that are in the dream that I'm making them known. He says, but it is for their sakes. And the word there is in italic, which really wasn't in the original. So it's for the sake of the things in the dream that this is going to be made known to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. So it's really a twofold purpose. So you can know what your heart's thinking, what you're dreaming, king, and also for the sake of the things that are revealed in this dream. Now truly, this is one of the greatest of all visions, and the most encompassing and all-sweeping of all visions in the Bible. Many doctrines built on it and built around it. Many interpretations given of it. Many shades of meaning given. But as we see the simple, true meaning of this, it's one of our most powerful bulwarks for realizing that the Old Testament prophesied what would happen and what did happen in the New Testament concerning the church. We're not going to get into this vision tonight because it's too all-encompassing for us to be able to even begin to deal with it. We will read a little bit of it, but then we want to come back later and try to give a more full explanation. Thou, O King, verse 31, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. Now what the king saw was a great image. A great image that was very bright. And a great image whose form, he says, was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thigh of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken into pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away. There was no place, that no place was found for them, and the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now that's the image, that's the dream, that's what he saw. To this point, there's no interpretation given of it. But we want to just read here what he says about this. This is the dream, and we'll tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beast of the field and the fowl of heaven hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art the head of gold. Truly, he had the greatest empire ever. And it might even have been the greatest empire ever since that time. Wherever men are, wherever the beasts of the field are, wherever the fowls of the air are, he says, you rule. He had a most powerful empire. Now this thing really, when its roots way back into Nimrod, had been in the making some 1,700 years. But in its zenith, in its epitome, in its greatest strength and glory known as Babylon proper, lasted for some 70 years, of which Nebuchadnezzar ruled 45. You're the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. And after thee shall rise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, and as iron that breaketh in all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were, part of iron, part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And we're going to close with this verse. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So we're going to close here, but let us just suffice at this point. We're going to go back over this vision next time. The head of gold was the Babylonian Empire. The breast and the arms were the Medo-Persian Empire, and this began with Cyrus, and then the belly and thighs They were made out of brass. This was the Macedonian or Grecian Empire, which had its center over here way past this area. And it was begun by Alexander the Great, and it didn't last too long until it began to divide, and it divided into two areas, Syria and Egypt, and these then became the legs of iron, which eventually then became the Roman Empire, and then the Roman Empire mixed and mingled with the foreign powers, which was iron mingling with clay. It wouldn't really mix, it shouldn't mix, and it then became the feet.